Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show.
Decades ago, Peter Shalit was a modest psychotherapist working in a small brick-and-mortar office. But as chance would have it, an entrepreneurial client turned his world upside down, showing him a whole new opportunity for entrepreneurial consulting and the path to tying his mental health practice to business. Jeff Steen here on the mic for this episode of ETR Radio, where Peter shares much of his own entrepreneurial journey with us and reveals many of the mental and emotional struggles and challenges that entrepreneurs face in 2018. His honesty about this niche practice is really eye-opening and sheds light on many of the questions and issues that get lost in the entrepreneurial pursuit of growing a business. Before we get to Peter's incredible stories and insights, though, I want to remind you that Early to Rise Radio is brought to you by the Perfect Day Formula. Grab your free copy of this blueprint to success and living the life of your dreams at freeperfectdaybook.com. It's a great companion to this interview with Peter. He even highlights the importance of philosophy for entrepreneurs, which is covered in spades in the Perfect Day Formula, and gives you even more tools to face the challenges of entrepreneurship while ensuring business success. All right, now let's get to that interview with the shrink for entrepreneurs, Peter Shalit. Hey there, ETR listeners. Jeff Steen again at the mic for this episode of Early to Rise Radio. And this episode, we have a special guest. Usually, I'm interviewing an entrepreneur, somebody in that vein, growing their business in the startup world. But this time, I guess we do have somebody in that vein this time too. But specifically, I want to talk to him about his role as shrink for entrepreneurs. So we have Peter Shalit on the show today. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Really appreciate it. So as I was looking for guests for the show, one of the things that occurred to me is that Craig Ballantyne, who's the owner of Early to Rise, deals with a lot of sort of mental hangups around moving forward in business, right? So I thought, well, let's dig up some questions and experts on mental health for entrepreneurs, and not surprisingly, you came up. And you sort of, you call yourself the shrink for entrepreneurs, but I think it's important to do a little definition work right now, because when it comes to roles in the mental health world, people are a little confused. So there's psychologists, psychiatrists, and then there's a therapist, counselor. What are the differences there, and where do you fall?
Yeah, good. That is a good and important question. So my like origin story is kind of unusual with this. I'm from New Zealand originally, and when my first business was a brick and mortar psychotherapy practice there. So I was like a licensed psychotherapist, which is more on that counseling therapist side, and that was many, many years ago and predated my entrepreneurial focus. So I was working with regular people for a whole host of sort of traditional like mental health issues. I took a lot of referrals from primary care physicians in the area, right, things like anxiety disorders and depression, addictions, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's like psychiatrist is something altogether different. It's somebody with a clinical psychology degree and a medical degree. So a psychiatrist is somebody who treats mental health. Typically, I can kind of make a generalization here. We don't need to get into the politics of this, but typically with like a pharmacological medical focus. So they're going to be writing scripts. They're mm-hmm. the people that you go to if you're looking for antidepressants and that kind of stuff. And then a psychologist as a term is like has a wide kind of range of definitions depending on where you are or what you're doing, and can run from like human resources people who have got that psychology background, right through to like a clinical psychologist who's like a, you know, who's a therapist essentially as well. So these days it's important to note, and I actually put this on my website, that I pretty much operate as a consultant of sorts, because I long ago left any affiliation with a professional regulatory body as I kind of got further and further into this niche of working with founders and entrepreneurs. So these days I'm sort of a business consultant, and I use that shrink for entrepreneurs as a tagline to kind of tell the story about my history and where my expertise and background comes from.
Sure. So I know you put this on your website as well, but it's always better to hear it from the source. What was this sort of strange journey from psychotherapy practice to this entrepreneurial consultant niche. How did you make that jump?
Yeah, so it kind of happened a little bit by accident. I was one of those people who found myself, there's a thing that happens to clinicians and service professionals. And I think the same is true, like even of people like dentists and lawyers and stuff like that, that people who go and study this stuff and get a sort of a professional trade, like a white collar trade or in that respect, have a rude awakening moment where they wake up one day and they realize that inadvertently they've become a business owner. That everything that they've learned and studied about being the best that they can be in their particular field is actually only half of the equation for kind of enjoying the success. And the problem is that many people in that position feel as though like it's kind of like an unfair rude awakening, right? And so that's exactly what happened to me. So I was super passionate about psychology. I studied in the field. I was, you know, I spent serious effort and considerable time and money becoming the absolute best at what I could do, and so, or sort of as far as I thought I could be. And then I was deeply frustrated by the fact that, you know, hordes of clients weren't just showing up to work with me. In fact, I knew next to nothing about customer acquisition or any... Yeah. I mean, it's almost hard to describe because it feels as a memory like a different person who just knew nothing about business and was frankly kind of resentful of like the fact that people, you know, mentors and friends were kind of telling me like, you got to do some sales and marketing, man. Like you've got to get out there. You got to put yourself out there. And I was like, right. That's not what they told me, you know? So what happened is I had a couple of business owners, sort of entrepreneurial types, actually come through my practice. I did have a few clients when I started out, and the business was kind of going okay-ish. And I met these people who were business owners, and I still remember, and I'm actually in touch with the first entrepreneur who ever kind of sat down in front of me in the office. And working with this guy was a revelation from the point of view of I guess like client compliance and follow through. What I found is that this guy was really hungry for tools to change. He had a terrific example of like what I later learned we could call a growth mindset. So one of the toughest things and one of the hardest things about therapy and why it's definitely a calling for some people and not others is that, you know, there's a tremendous amount of resistance. A lot of people who show up to do that work are pretty stuck and don't even necessarily want to change in a lot of ways. So you've got to do a lot of, a lot of empathetic cajoling. And what I found is that work was for me personally particularly exhausting, and I'm in awe of the people who are called to it and who love that stuff. But working with these entrepreneurs was just like a revelation. This first guy, he came in to see me to get rid of a flying phobia that was really holding back his ability to kind of grow his business in other areas besides the place he lived. And he had lots of opportunities, and he knew that he needed to get on planes. And so we managed to rapidly work through that. I gave him a bunch of kind of exercises, and he went and did his homework, and he came back and was like, that worked. I'm on the airplanes. Here's some other stuff I want to work on. And so there was this pragmatic like willingness to kind of grow and change and lead into that stuff that was a revelation. And we sort of struck up a relationship, and he started schooling me a little bit on my business and sort of was the first person who was able to really persuade me, make me see the light that I needed to learn about business if I wanted to be in business, which I was doing. I was fully self-employed. And that kicked off from him a chain of referrals to other business owners in his personal and social network. And for me, the sort of lifelong journey of kind of my second field of study, which was like entrepreneurship and business itself. And so, I mean, we're fast forwarding like a very long story, forward really quickly to say that I ended up finding more and more clients in that space. One day I kind of woke up and my entire client roster was self-employed people. I had folks who were leaders and sort of the larger like enterprise level business world bring me in to work with their teams. I built a reputation helping out high-performing salespeople really around like making sure that if any kind of personal psychological issues prevented them from performing, I would often be called in to solve those problems. Mm-hmm. And yeah, at one point I decided there was really something about the sort of intersection and business and about business and psychology. And I started blogging about that intersection, about those two things back in the day when really no one was doing it. And I had that kind of early movers advantage. I landed on, I didn't know how to describe what I did, but I landed on this kind of tagline of the shrink for entrepreneurs as some of the most profound sort of marketing hustle of all time. And that brand and the blogging that I was doing just kind of blew up, built me an international audience with what I was doing online, and filled up my client roster with remote, like phone-based, you know, entrepreneurs who were founders of some fast growth startups and like really sexy stuff in the venture capital backed technology world. And I mean, the rest is kind of history. I started that blog in, I think, 2006. And so now, I mean, I'm sitting here and it's been a crazy journey. I was like, you know, in New Zealand in a little kind of brick and mortar suburban office doing psychotherapy. And I'm sat here right now in my office space, which I share with a venture capital firm. I work out of a venture capital firm here in New York, where I manage my like private client roster, run a little bootstrap startup of my own, and still have a roster of some of the best and brightest entrepreneurs doing some of the coolest, most interesting stuff in the world. So yeah, it's been a
roller coaster in a good way, for sure. It's interesting that the way you described the sort of the transition into helping entrepreneurs and then also business leaders and the teams within business. What is the difference between that and, say, occupational psychology?
I think that my focus has always been very kind of individual, that the folks that, sorry, if you're hearing the sirens in the
that's right.
Downtown Manhattan. I think the performance focus has been really significant. My expertise is in the kind of positive psychology space, and I've kind of continued as I've lent into this and being on this journey of working with entrepreneurs to explore those aspects of psychology that are really have evolved in the last 20 to 30 years that are dedicated to kind of the study of really excellence and performance behavior, like how, you know, it's the cheesy self-help phrase, but how people can go from good to great. And so I think that aspect was particularly appealing to, you know, there's a lot of leaders, even in the corporate sort of enterprise world, CEOs, that kind of level, who feel as though they know the changes that they want to kind of implement in their companies and what's going to really drive the growth and performance that they want, but need help kind of with the human piece of actually having people, you know, do what they want, of having people kind of take advantage of the opportunity and fulfill their potential. So that focus of mine was particularly, you know, useful for, and just pragmatic for the folks that I've been working with.
Sure. No, that absolutely makes sense. And one of the things you mentioned before is this sort of that revelatory moment when you had an entrepreneur come in the door as a client back in your psychotherapy days, and he really did his homework and he was really interested in moving ahead. And it seemed like there was nothing blocking that path. As soon as he took the step to come in and see you and you gave him the exercises, then it was sort of that he's gone, he's growing from there. Which makes me think that for entrepreneurs, and this is a blanket statement, but for entrepreneurs, the stigma of seeking help for mental health isn't there in the same way it is for the general population. Is that a fair statement in your experience?
Oof. that's a big one. I got to think carefully about that. I think that there is the problem about a blanket statement like that is that there's different types of mental health challenges, and I think the stigmas are different. So that specific example is kind of perfect in a sense, because it was somebody with like a flying phobia that they were quite clear and willing to admit that it was a totally irrational, you know, the thing about phobias is that they're almost ridiculous. Right. And most people who suffer from a phobia have at least some aspect of their psyche that realizes like there's no way a human being should be this afraid of praying mantises or like getting on an airplane or whatever. Right. So I think that the the proactive willingness, the sort of growth mindset to like get tools and apply them and kind of follow through and do the exercises was really obvious there. And I think for, as a blanket statement, that's typically present for entrepreneurs, because most entrepreneurs, if they're successful at all, have sort of trained themselves to take an outsized responsibility for their own thinking and behavior, and even almost like pathologically for the world around them as well. Entrepreneurs take a lot of ownership for the kind of results and circumstances and what's going on in their life, which kind of gives them a lot of personal power to make that change. And I think that was what was exciting to me about kind of connecting with that initial client. Now, on the heavier mental health side of things, when we're talking about, you know, the big stuff, depression, anxiety, you know, disorders and problems, that sort of thing, I think that there still can be a kind of a stigma amongst entrepreneurs around all of that kind of stuff. And I think that like in the last 5 years, I've seen social media in particular have like a bit of an impact on that, where there's become, entrepreneurship has become sort of fetishized as a lifestyle choice. And for a lot of entrepreneurs who have been entrepreneurs for a long time, they're sort of now realizing, wow, I should be like, I should have an Instagram account. I should be posting on Facebook. I should be broadcasting to the sort of wider community and world what it is that my life is about. And the thing about that sort of mentality is that entrepreneurship requires like an incredible amount of sort of dealing with ambiguity and uncertainty, right? There's an incredible amount of risk, especially as people start building bigger businesses, you know, getting into the kind of fast growth world of venture-backed startups where other people's money is on the line and you're taking on a lot of risk to grow things really quickly. And so it isn't super rosy and it doesn't all look like vacation pictures and traveling around the world and all that kind of stuff. And I think there is a little bit of a stigma, because I think entrepreneurs expect and want to broadcast, and certainly if they have investors, it's critical that they're telling a story of incredible competence, of really having, you know, to be blunt, like having one's shit together, you know, in a profound way. And there's times in almost everyone's life, if you're pushing forward on goals that are kind of that aggressive and incur that much risk, that you're going to have a few dark nights. And I think that, yeah, I think that it's still tough. I mean, the majority of clients on my roster who have worked on some of the heaviest things take privacy and confidentiality incredibly seriously. They wouldn't want anyone at their company or certainly any investor to know that they're, you know, that they're gazing into this existential void and asking these kind of heavy questions and working through some heavy stuff. So yeah, I definitely think that there's, you know, culturally, there's probably some work to kind of do there. The one thing I would say is that compared to the rest of the population, like choosing this journey, the type of entrepreneurship and these challenges I'm talking about, we're talking about a tiny sort of 0.01% of the population here. And it, you know, and they are making a choice to live a very, very different life. But, you know, I think not too many people want to talk about the benefits of entrepreneurship. And there's a reason why it's like the new rock star. You know, kids want to drop out of college, not to like start a band anymore. It's to like become an entrepreneur, start an app company, be the next Zuckerberg. And So I think there is still a bit of a gap.
There's a lot of fetishizing, I mean, in society as a whole, but it's interesting you point that out about entrepreneurship, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that's been the case before in at least Western history. I think that's a relatively new thing. You said part of your mission, and this is something that you're very upfront about, is helping for-profit businesses grow while also making positive change. And that positive change piece is very important to you. But that also sounds pretty ambiguous. So for-profit businesses, we can all wrap our heads around that. What does positivity or positive change look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. My kind of passion and where this ties up sort of psychologically is that my thesis is that most people are drawn to entrepreneurship because they want wealth and they want freedom. And sometimes they want impact as well, right? Like sometimes people have want to make a dent in the universe mentality. One of the things that I've observed over the years of working with these people is that if they're able to create significant wealth and they're able to create significant freedom, and they can do those, have those two things without sort of paying a price with their sanity, right? Like being able to kind of sustainably have those two things, that what happens next is really interesting. That most people who go down that path and actually accomplish it kind of work to make those things happen. And then as soon as they've got it, they'll celebrate, they'll take a vacation, and like 3 to 6 months later, be bored out of their mind.
Yeah, I've seen that happen.
And what happens next is interesting, where they start to realize that they've been validated. Whatever itch they were trying to scratch, you know, whoever they were trying to prove wrong, you know, like, and even if it's just a sort of a demon in their head that they were trying to silence and say, you know what, I can do this, I can make some big thing happen, whatever it is that they were trying to accomplish, it's been done. And so they get to really think about, well, how am I going to spend my time, you know, here on earth? And I think that I've seen a lot of entrepreneurs, sort of, I guess, like this generation of them, 21st century sort of entrepreneurs, start to think more philanthropically and start to think about business with benefit, you know, maybe building a hybrid like business that's designed to make a profit and make some kind of an impact, you know, positively in the world as well. And some really kind of cool ventures come about as a result of it. And so I look at what I do and really being as a function of like accelerating this process, that anytime I'm working with an entrepreneur who's like, I just want to get that FU money, you know, like somebody who's just got this pure capitalistic vision of like, I'm in it to win it, I'm going to get what's mine, I'm going to win. I'm excited to help that person accelerate that journey, because I know when they're done, when they pop the champagne on the, you know, like the product launch or the IPO or the exit or whatever it is, that they're not going to immediately just collapse into like a pile of ashes and depart from this earth, right? They're going to have like maybe years left of life to live. And I think that's sure. Where the impact comes from.
Yeah, that's interesting you paint it that way, because I would have assumed that as part of that impact goal at the outset of their career to their entrepreneurial journey, it was a balance of, I mean, everybody wants the money and success in that form, but also the positive community, global impact, whatever their vision is, together at the same time. But what I hear from you is that usually the money is the primary focus until an itch is scratched and there's some sort of psychology behind that. And then once that's sorted, then they can move on to the positivity. Is it definitely the latter? Or
yeah, I wouldn't say it's always the primary focus. I think that like Maslow's hierarchy of needs tells us that people need to have a baseline of that sort of stuff taken care of, that like contribution comes after security in most people's kind of hierarchy of values, right? Most human beings. So, I mean, but certainly there's plenty of entrepreneurs who have achieved like some semblance of sort of first world security who, you know, who still want to go bigger and do better for themselves personally and financially. But yeah, there's plenty of people out there who also want to, you know, make a difference and build something that makes an impact. And I certainly, you know, I love those businesses too, right? And I certainly have many clients who are on that spectrum where they've figured out something that is a for-profit business that nevertheless is making the world a better place. You know, like just look at any solar company or any sort of kind of mission purpose driven business. There's plenty of people, for example, in the medical cannabis space right now, where there's some interesting startups and VC dollars galore pouring into that space. And almost all of the founders like really believe that what they're doing is going to really help people, you know, and there's certainly strong arguments that they're correct, right? Like the,
sure,
whether it's like a medical solution or it's, you know, like recreational and getting people off of like other more dangerous recreational drug use, that kind of stuff. So there's plenty of for-profit businesses that make an impact anyway. I just know that it's sort of almost guaranteed that if any entrepreneur's cup runneth over in terms of their personal definition of success, that after kind of hunting around, that, you know, psychologically people want for purpose, you know, like,
And
I think that that's where it comes from. And certainly that's what, you know, people like Maslow theorized, was that when we've really checked off all the other boxes in our lives, the thing that is left is sort of impact and potentially legacy. And so those, you know, as motivating forces, some really interesting stuff gets built when people are free to just wholeheartedly full-time work on that project.
Do you find that when you're dealing with a lot of entrepreneurs, I suppose particularly younger ones who are early on in their journey, that they are very driven, and that's evident in the work that they're doing, but a lot of them don't really know why they're driven. They don't understand what the motivation is for them, like internally, to do all this work. and then they have to discover it later. Like, what, how do you deal with those people? First of all, is that predominant? Like, does that happen a lot for you and the people that you deal with? And then, what are some tools that you use to help them understand what that motivation is?
Yeah, I think that, that's a good question. So I think that certainly there are a lot of people who kind of, who go on that journey. One of the things that happens, and I would guess that almost anyone listening to this has, regardless of how successful you may or may not be, has had some experience of this already in life, which is that we set goals that we think are important to us. And, you know, and the younger we are, right, like the more kind of, you know, different those goals might be. And when we go and accomplish them, the weird kind of sort of tragedy, sort of simultaneous joy and tragedy of goal accomplishment for a lot of young people is learning that the things that they thought would fulfill them and make them happy actually don't. Or don't in quite the way that they thought they did, or it wasn't exactly what they thought about that thing that would make them happy, right? Like, how many people have had, as a teenage boy, for example, I mean, just personal kind of goal I can relate to, have thought that the coolest thing in the world would be having like a high performance sports car. And then actually, for a lot of successful entrepreneurs who create a few wins early on in life, they kind of have the resources to go and make that happen. And then they go and buy it and they drive it around. And then they realize, like, this doesn't actually make me feel that different. After the kind of the glow, the rosy glow of that purchase wears off, then suddenly they're kind of left wondering, well, I don't feel as excited as I thought I would when I was 14 years old and all I wanted was like a Cadillac or a Porsche or whatever. You know what I mean? And so then they have to kind of go back to the drawing board and scratch their head and ask, well, what is it that really matters to me? And I'm, you know, cars are, it's like a cliched example, and I dare say kind of like untrendy these days anyway. But I think that to some degree, almost all young entrepreneurs' goals meet this kind of, follow the same kind of pattern. Like, I've certainly worked with I've seen a lot of founders in the VC world think that the coolest thing in the world would be to get an investor and have capital to kind of go grow the business. And before they've done that, all they can think about is how great life is going to be when they're a VC-backed startup founder. And so they make that their mission. And if they accomplish it, if they come up with a great idea and they find people who are receptive to the pitch and somebody actually writes them a check, they have this elated high. And then when it wears off, the realization that they're now on the hook financially to produce a return on investment for probably like a really smart kind of hard-nosed capitalist who's like going to push them and make sure that they get their money and some back. And then suddenly they realize, like, I've really got myself into something here. And then the goalpost moves and it's like, oh, I have to build this thing and I'll feel really great when we're profitable or when we have fine product market fit or when we exit this business. And so that is the kind of psychological journey of entrepreneurship, particularly when we get started young, is we have these things that we think we want. And then if we're lucky and we work hard, we accomplish them. And then we learn the hard way that it's actually something else that we want. And I mean, that's really a journey of self-awareness that I want my clients to go along, is to figure out throughout their journey as an entrepreneur, what it is that actually matters to them, what it is that ultimately makes them happy and fulfilled. And surprise, surprise, it's probably not the things that you thought were important when you're 14, but it might be things that you've figured out and gotten clarity on by the time you were, I don't know, 35, 45, you know, it depends, differs from person to person.
Sure, of course. Yeah, that's interesting. And I see that, you know, at play on a regular basis. It's a question, I think, a lot of self-awareness and just being willing to take a look inside. A lot of entrepreneurs, I think, are just so gung-ho on the future and moving forward that, at least in my experience, they're not as self-aware as they might be.
Definitely. And in a perfect world, my favorite way to kind of increase people's self-awareness around this stuff is actually to accelerate the goal accomplishment. Like, I think that if you're privileged enough to have like a good opportunity and you really think that all you want in life is to build a business so you can have the FU money so you can buy the fast car, like, do all of that. feel the emptiness inside when you're done with it. And because the skill set that you will have built, the experiences, the street smarts to actually get to that point, then you can go trade the car in for like something sensible and get back to like, to the next phase of the journey. So I think that there's definitely an argument for like kind of moving people along that journey and having them actually do all of it. You know, it's certainly better than spending your entire life wondering if that Cadillac would have deeply fulfilled you, but never having actually had the experience of finding out that it won't.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, let's talk about some of the in the vein of sort of helping people in their realization, self-realization. There's a lot of tools out there that entrepreneurs currently reach for to help them on their path to growing their business, growing their own motivation and self-improvement, all that good stuff. And I know that in my world, there are a lot of books floating out there written by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs, written by mental health specialists for entrepreneurs. You know, it runs the gamut. So I'm wondering, the books, sort of the self-help books, and that's a big category, but the self-help books that are out there specifically for entrepreneurs, what is good in that realm? Like, what do you point to that's actually beneficial, and what are the potential pitfalls of going to those resources for help?
I tend to recommend and do a lot of reading that is psychological in nature and less entrepreneurial specific. I think I haven't been like super impressed with many of the kind of like books that are designed for entrepreneurs alone. The reason is that the market, it's purely like an economics kind of reason, actually. The market for entrepreneur self-help as like a niche of that self-help kind of pop psychology category is much smaller than self-help itself, right? Like my friend Mark Manson wrote The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, and that book sold millions and millions of copies because it's kind of for everyone, right? So like that book for entrepreneurs is going to sell proportionately, you know, fewer and fewer copies. And so that means that the market for that kind of literature for successful entrepreneurs, for the kind of issues like that we've just been talking about, where you sort of make stuff happen and accomplish goals and build businesses, and then you find out the sort of the real first world champagne problems that happen for people at that next level of success. There isn't really a huge market, so not too many books are written there. One of the jokes I often make with my clients when we're really kind of digging in on an issue and they're sort of talking through maybe a dark night of the soul and a challenge that they're facing, and I'm kind of helping them and holding space around that, I'll make the joke that like, well, you can't find a medium.com article that talks about this one, because, you know, they may be the founder of a company with a big market cap that's growing fast. They're, you know, maybe hired 100 employees in the last 12 months. And it's like, there's just not that much stuff out there that deals with that kind of stuff. So I really like, I like the literature that is written by, you know, like researchers, a lot of academic psychologists. I think philosophy is a profound, like, untapped source that ties in really nicely with all of that. That really deals with the highest levels of kind of performance and sort of philosophical insight that anyone can benefit from. But I think entrepreneurs can just read that stuff through the lens of like, how does this matter to me? One of my favorite books of all time is, I wonder if I have it sitting here, is The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Won a Pulitzer Prize in the 70s, I think, when it came out. And it's a book about Freudian psychoanalysis, what Freud got right and what he got wrong. And it's basically a unified theory of human motivation, why it is that humans do all of the stuff that they do. And for an entrepreneur to read that, it's like shining a light onto that part of them that is manically, like maniacally driven to accomplish huge big things.
Yes,
and it can blow entrepreneurial minds wide open. It's like that's a book that's sort of for everybody, but through that entrepreneurial lens really puts a context around like, here's why you're so driven, why the stuff matters to you. So
there's this interesting overlap between what you do, and there's clear differences here, but I want to sort of make it clear what those differences and similarities are. But again, in my world, I deal with a lot of entrepreneurs, and those entrepreneurs are often encouraged to seek out business coaches, those who have been more successful and who've come before them. And as part of that business coaching, it's more than just, here's how you grow your business. It's, here's what's blocking you mentally. Here's why you can't, you know, achieve X, Y, Z. Here's why you're not setting the right goals, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So in your mind, what is it that a business coach does that you don't do and vice versa? Where's there the overlap? Where, if I were a brand new entrepreneur and somebody on one side was saying, you need a business coach, and somebody else on the other side was saying, hey, you need Peter, how would I know where to go, when, and for what?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, a huge amount of what I actually do, you could kind of put under the umbrella of business coaching. I think that there's a couple of different ways that I look at it. I think that it's, one of the things that I'll often recommend my clients do, and this is especially true in the startup world where, you know, there's very few people who are kind of on a similar journey, is to really look for somebody as a mentor who's like about 6 to 12 months ahead of where they are in that incredibly like fast-paced sort of trajectory of like raising successive rounds, staffing up, and sort of attacking a vertical and trying to like eat up a bunch of users. You know, a lot of VC-backed technology companies are ultimately in a race against competitors or against time for some reason to kind of dominate a marketplace and get a really strong position. So I think there's a sort of a coaching that comes from, I've been there and done that. And one of the things I've learned and kind of observed is that recency is incredibly valuable for that stuff. That talking to somebody who did what you want to do, but 10, 20 years ago, comes with a whole other set of sort of cognitive biases that cloud the person's ability to really accurately help you out. But it's incredibly powerful to just grab a beer with someone who's like 6 months further along in that like fundraising trajectory or that hiring trajectory or whatever, and break down what it is that they're doing, what they're focusing on right now. And because you can just ask them one simple coaching, like mentoring question, which is, what do you wish you knew 6 months ago? And boom, right. Like they'll talk about that all night long. Then I think that there's another kind, I mean, there's obviously business coaches who are like, you know, who's, I mean, business coaching is the craziest industry, right? There's like thousands of, tens, hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to be business coaches. And I think that I'm very cynical about the industry overall, but I think that there is a reason for optimism about coaching in general, which is that the reason it's such a big thing and that so many people are kind of interested in it and want to be it is because it works. That ultimately any form of sort of showing up and having someone hold space for you, connecting with them to talk about how it is that you're doing, actually is effective in modifying human behavior and helping people take a little baby step towards kind of being a better version for themselves. And there's a tremendous amount of research in the positive psychology space that shows that the simple power of human social accountability, that having an individual who's literally paid to care, actually really profoundly modifies human behavior and helps people do things like be better at delayed gratification, work harder in the present and in the short term for a longer, you know, for the long-term payoff. So we, you know, so even bad coaching, right? Like even unqualified, you know, like your buddy or whatever, like some person you found on Instagram coaching is ultimately going to be effective in some small way. So, you know, that's I think why it kind of works. What I do obviously has the, you know, I have the background of having done my 10,000 hours of, you know, of the more kind of psychological, clinical dealing with the, you know, the heavier stuff. And most of the people who refer people to my practices, I'm usually getting pretty sensitive referrals that are around, you know, somebody who's connected with a founder who's opened up to them and said, I'm really struggling with like the stress of this, or, you know, some pretty heavy psychological aspect. And that's why people seek me out.
It seems to me that it would be, it would be advantageous to set up a model whereby you partner or collaborate with business coaches so that you could get both sides of that, not at the same time, but in conjunction and work in collaboration, so that you sort of feed off each other, the business coach, and you have the psychological component, and then they have the business coaching and a little bit of both for both of you. Is that something you've ever dabbled in, or?
So, and yeah, so in a couple ways, like one of the, what I just kind of spoke to was the impact and power of the accountability aspect of business coaching.
Yeah.
I actually started a business designed to basically extract just the accountability component and none of the prescriptive, strategic, or tactical advice giving, and create like a low cost way of delivering raw accountability to small business owners. And so that's my other project. That's what I spend my time working on when I'm not with my clients. And so I actually have quite a few of my clients who utilize that service. And the thing about the work I do is I'll be the first to admit I'm not a huge accountability guy. Like I'll go deep with my clients. I love to have those existential conversations. That's my sort of zone of genius and my sweet spot. And it's the work that really kind of fulfills and energizes me. If I've got a client who desperately needs to get a text message on Monday morning to say, like, make sure you do the thing, make sure you follow through, that's not the kind of work that I'm drawn to. So I spun up another company that delivers that, where we have highly trained kind of accountability experts. We call them executive effectiveness aides. And that's really like the metaphor is really, this is more like a personal assistant whose singular job is to like manage your focus and effectiveness. So I've done that. And then certainly a lot of my clients have like a whole host of advisors, mentors, and tactical business coaches around different parts of what it is that they work on that they'll work with as well. I don't necessarily prescriptively like instruct clients to kind of partner with who I recommend for that. I kind of, the thing about entrepreneurs is that they're lone wolves, they're highly decisive, assertive people. And so sometimes it's best to just kind of work around what they've built for themselves in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does make sense that a lot of them will have come to you already having an army of coaches and mentors and tacticians, as you said, to help them out. And then you're able to help with some of the other pieces of that puzzle.
Certainly. Yeah. And one of the areas that I don't have a ton of expertise on, for example, and I have a few people I know that I often refer people out to, is the actual like HR component, which is really important around like management, sort of coaching, consulting, training. I'm not necessarily the best person for a founder to talk to about like, how do I lead my team? And that's a real journey that a lot of entrepreneurs make, because they start off as like, you know, they're passionate about an opportunity or maybe a product, or, you know, they're a certain domain expertise. If they're like a technical founder, they might be like an engineer or something. And then if they're successful, if they hit a home run, they'll find themselves like with 50 people in an office kind of looking at them on Monday morning being like, what do we do, boss? And so, you know, that whole challenge, I think there's a huge demand for people who can help entrepreneurs like scale up intelligently and, you know, figure out how to run meetings effectively and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, most founders are too busy building products and finding product market fit to like go to business school and learn all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You know, a lot of them are super eager to start early, especially if they have a good idea, then they figure it out as they go. A lot of OJT for many of them. You know, we've been talking a lot about some of the struggles that are common for entrepreneurs. And so that's a good segue, because I do want to talk about some of the biggest problems and struggles you're seeing entrepreneurs facing right now and sort of what you're seeing going into the future. And the first one I want to call out, and then we can kind of go more generally if there are other ones that come to mind. But do you get a sense that in the entrepreneurial world, there is, even for maybe even for female entrepreneurs, that there's sort of this almost machoism, and maybe machoism isn't the right word, but sort of this inability to emote, or that emotion doesn't figure into the process because it would trip them up on their path to achievement? Is that something that you see pretty commonly?
Yeah, there's definitely a school of thought, and I would say that the people who are proponent, like well-known folks who are proponents of this, run from like Warren Buffett to, you know, even people like Peter Thiel, who have talked and written at length about this, about sort of like ultra rationality, about the opportunity that for entrepreneurs to kind of overcome their overcome their cognitive biases and bias association, their sort of emotional tendencies, and make sort of like robotic, data-driven decisions about, you know, to do the best thing, to find the best opportunity, or whatever the decision is in business.
Right.
And I definitely think that attitude, you know, that sort of robotification of business and entrepreneurship makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of those people aren't wrong. There's a lot of like, there's a lot of opportunity for people who can think clearly and really rationally, while most other people can't, to kind of take advantage of those gaps in the market and win as entrepreneurs because of it. But it does lead to a bit of a disconnect in terms of emotional intelligence. And yeah, I definitely think that a lot of entrepreneurs want to feel as though they sort of want to tell themselves and other people around them the story of a story of incredible sort of personal accomplishment and personal power and responsibility, that they have the ability to kind of have it all, to run these big companies and push themselves to perform in all these different directions. A tremendous amount of entrepreneurs that I speak to have incredible goals for themselves in relation to like their personal health, where they should be at personally in terms of like their significant other relationship. And they really have looked at that sort of wheel of life diagram and decided that they want to have 11 out of 10 in every single different category. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I think that like emotional vulnerability doesn't have a place when you're trying to be superhuman in all of those different, spaces. And, you know, that's why I think at the same time, like the media and the public at large are obsessed with entrepreneurs who are, you know, who are kind of failing to measure up to that, right? Like one of the biggest stories was last year was that went around the internet was, I think it was maybe in Vanity Fair. I could have this wrong, but Neil Strauss did a feature article, an interview with Elon Musk, where he kind of went through and talked about why he does everything that he does. And what he's driven by. And ultimately this journalist got him to say that really all he really wants is to kind of feel loved, and that he's, you know, that ultimately he was lonely. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, that was a big story, as though like, can you believe it? But of course, because these people are human. And so I think you're right. Like their entrepreneurship has this sort of inflated identity. There's this narrative of becoming superhuman, which to kind of carry that around as a set of expectations for yourself is an exhausting amount of cognitive dissonance, you know, between that narrative and the reality that we're all, you know, we're all messy. We're all people. We all have our stuff.
Exactly. And that if you fail, if you trip, it's not the end of the world. You can still get up and move forward.
Totally.
I know that's a big lesson for a lot of people to learn, but I think for entrepreneurs, it might be a, you know, even harder one to learn. What about the realm of, especially in this day and age with technology just booming, and the capabilities, which are great for business, getting to the point where it's not getting to the point, we've been like connected 24/7 for quite some time now, and we're getting information all the time in a million different ways. So how is that something you're seeing manifest as a problem with some of the entrepreneurs you deal with, and how do you deal with that?
Oh my goodness. So a couple of weeks ago, a little side project of mine is that I run a sort of a men's emotional support group also for entrepreneurs, where they kind of get together and talk about their personal lives, how they relate to their significant others, their feelings and whatnot. And we go on retreats. We sort of facilitate these retreats, and we did one of these with a bunch of these entrepreneurial guys, but we actually went out whitewater rafting in the Sawtooth Mountains, the Middle Fork Salmon River in Idaho. This is miles from the nearest, not only the nearest cell phone tower, but the nearest electricity. So it was totally disconnected for 5 days in the wilderness. We traversed 100 miles of the river in rafts and kind of camped and cooked on a fire at night. And like real kind of nature, back to the roots stuff.
Yeah.
And I realized when I came back from this, that this was the first time for me personally in what could have been like the best part of a decade, where I had been completely disconnected from technology for 5 days in a row. Like no screen, no email, no phone call, no text message, just zero. Like just me and the people that I can see and talk to, because I can literally see and hear them. And I felt like a different person. when I kind of checked into the hotel that we stayed at one night before heading to the airport and leaving from this sort of adventure, there was like a calmness in my mind that I didn't even know was possible. And that's when I kind of realized it was the icing on the cake for me of like a thesis that I've been building that, you know, that our devices, the constant connection, you know, not just the social media, but I think that's a big part of it, but just always being reachable, always being plugged in and on, is actually fundamentally kind of rewiring our brain. And people tell me, and they're not alone, like everybody is starting to feel as though it's harder and harder with every year that goes by to just focus, to sit down and work on something uninterrupted for like an hour or more. Like increasingly people get their work done in sort of like 3 to 7 minute chunks of time before something pings and notifies them. So yeah. The crazy thing about all of this is that I think despite how plugged in we are, a lot of entrepreneurs are feeling kind of more isolated than ever. They feel a sort of a disconnect between the connections that they build, like through these devices and genuine kind of human like intimacy and connection. And so, yeah, there's definitely something going on. And I think that it probably hit a tipping point in the last year or two where people started to realize that like there's been a change I've noticed in the sort of media narrative around like technology is great and imagine where these tools will take us, to now there's like a lot of kind of op-ed pieces. There's a lot of books, a lot of articles being written kind of saying like, maybe we've gone too far here. Maybe we need to detox and cut back. And I certainly like had this experience of realizing that I need to personally make time to disconnect like completely, that we should all have like a week every year or 6 months or hell every like quarter where we actually just get off the grid, because I don't know, I feel like I can't even think properly anymore. And certainly a lot of my clients feel the same way.
Yeah, it does change the way you actually think. It becomes sort of fractured thinking. And it's difficult when, you know, I know some clients that Craig at Early Tries has worked with, you know, I've talked to them and, you know, they'll fully embrace the idea of focused work. But having been mired in this digital world for so long and constant connectivity, they sit down to do deep work for even half an hour or an hour. And it's so difficult. It's so difficult. Even with distraction gone, they start looking for distractions. They start creating distractions for themselves because they're so used to just having those distractions. It's
right. It's like our brains have been trained to look for, like to anticipate that external stimulation. And I think that we get bored, but you know, more easily than ever before. And it certainly took some like adjusting, you know, there was like a restlessness in our group when we were out there doing this, like sitting around the fire. And look, there was 25 entrepreneurs there. I can't even imagine what it would have been like if I did something like this alone, right? I probably would have gone insane. At least I had people to talk to. We could kind of create our own version of Twitter around the campfire and engaged. So yeah, there's definitely something going on, and I think we're just kind of scratching the surface, and it's just a revolution is just kind of beginning. But I've noticed that, you know, that's a priority. It's sort of on the agenda of things to talk about with that I'm chatting about with a lot of entrepreneurs these days, is like deep work, how to get more focus, how to get disconnected, you know, people considering deleting Facebook, getting off of these things, trying to get away from it all. Yeah. The number of folks I meet who have turned their smartphone screen gray, right? Like only black and white and gray shades, to kind of decrease the candy-like visual engagement of it. So, and most of the people who do this kind of stuff are actually working and living in like these tech hubs, working in these tech industries as well. And they know, like they've seen firsthand how crazy it can get and are taking steps to kind of course correct.
Yeah. I mean, in tech, buried in tech, I would have no idea. It's bad enough outside of it. One more question for you, because I know we're running out of time, but I have noticed that entrepreneurs, like many groups of people, you sort of find your clique and you sort of stick with it. You know those people, you're comfortable with them, you have a lot in common with them. But with entrepreneurs, given the way they think, given their motivation and their drive, feeding off of each other, I could see that being very positive, but also being negative, perhaps. Can you speak to that? Is that something, one, you see a lot? And two, do you try to discourage it, encourage it, balance it?
I think pragmatically that there's like a really good argument for maintaining connections and socializing outside of the entrepreneurial world. I'm not the best example for this. I'm kind of immersed in it. My entire social circle is made up of entrepreneurs at this point. Part of that is because I'm an immigrant. I moved, like as an adult, I moved from New Zealand to the US. And when I kind of arrived here, I moved to New York and I basically just started hanging out with people who were like-minded, who are entrepreneurs. So my friends who I went to high school with and things like that, they're buddies of mine back in New Zealand, but I don't have so much to do with them these days because I'm far away. So I think that there's a really strong argument though for entrepreneurs to kind of have a diverse circle socially. One of the big reasons for that is that it really helps founders stay in touch with the consumer market, that if you want to build products and services for people that are, you know, that are powerfully engaging and achieve product market fit, you've got to know who the people are. And I think one of the biggest challenges that entrepreneurs face is the exercise of genuine empathy, of truly being able to put yourselves in your target market's shoes and understand what it is that people want and really need. And that exercise, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs get started building something to scratch an itch. They create a product where they themselves are the target markets, you know, and they kind of, if they're lucky that they are actually representative of a decent population of people, like a big demographic, psychographic niche who have the same problem. And that's how good scratch your own itch businesses are formed. But it's essential that we don't, as entrepreneurs, like get cloistered away in these entrepreneurial silos where we're just building product, like building software solutions for other entrepreneurs, because there's a much wider market out there of people who care about very different things. And I think that I'm trying to remember which, there was like an old-timey copywriting direct response marketing genius. I think it was Claude Hopkins who like swore by his hometown in like Western Virginia or somewhere, something like that, where he would go out and hang out even when he was like filthy rich and had an ad agency in Manhattan and blah, blah, blah. He would go back and hang out at his like lake house or farm or whatever it was and talk to the, what he called the common folk, right? Very like old timey, politically incorrect ways of putting it. But the point that he made was that he's on Madison Avenue writing ad copy to sell things to these people. And so like to believe that he's better than them and to isolate himself from those people is could cost him his entire livelihood. So I think there's a pragmatic, not to mention like generally moral and sort of like positively political reason for kind of trying to break down these increasing barriers between like knowledge economy workers and coastal type cities and the consumer markets that they ultimately aim to serve.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point that it benefits business as well as one's own personhood and that development. I think that's important to note. One more question. I'll leave you with this. We could keep talking, of course, but we're at an hour. So is there anything in the realm, I mentioned this earlier, but any in the realm of, you know, 2018 and on entrepreneurship as it is changing that new entrepreneurs should be aware of, particular pitfalls or dangers or challenges that it would be helpful for them to know in advance so that they can meet it prepared?
Well, I mean, I think we kind of talked about it, that I think in the next generation of entrepreneurs, like there's a bunch of researchers in the sort of psych area around like conscientiousness and these different dimensions of like basically industriousness and goal accomplishment. And there's a lot of research and literature that kind of suggests that self-regulation is the major social pathology of our time. And that certainly like in young people, the ability to apply oneself, to focus, to manage what neuroscientists call executive function is increasingly becoming a rarer and rarer skill. So the ability to put down the Instagram, right, to like get off of that stuff and to actually work hard and execute on whatever your vision is going to increasingly be a rare opportunity. And so that stuff, it's a double-edged sword because it is literally getting harder and harder because teams of PhDs, you know, in psychology and engineering, computer science are working around the clock to create these products that engage and monetize your attention. We're increasingly living in an attention economy, right? Where our focus is being sold to the highest bidder. But our ability to unhook from that, to go from consuming content to actually creating something, is, I think, that I think is going to be the thing that sets people apart, that sort of separates the winners.
Notes for future generations. Thank you so much for your time, Peter. I really appreciate it. Before we let you go, what's the best way to get a hold of you? Is there anything you'd like to push or promote that's coming out your way, a book or event or something like that?
My home on the internet is petershellard.com. You can read all of my writing about entrepreneurship and psychology and all that fun stuff there. It's also easy to get a hold of me if you want to reach me and have questions or anything like that, or just want to connect. You can grab my email at petershellard.com on the contact page. And then the other thing is my bootstrap startup. It's called Commit Action, commitaction.com. That's where we have this accountability service where we help entrepreneurs by matching them up with an executive effectiveness aide. It's like a personal trainer for productivity. It's a really kind of cool remote service where you can very cost effectively get someone on your team, even if it's only a team of one at this point, whose singular job it is to kind of help you be the highest leverage version of yourself. So those are my two major things. And yeah, I look forward to connecting with any listener who wants to know more.
Yeah, lots to look into for sure. Again, thanks so much for your time. Hopefully we'll get you back on the podcast at some point in the future, because like I said, there's a lot more we didn't talk about. But
for sure. Yeah, I'd love to continue chatting. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thanks, Peter, for taking so much time away from your busy work schedule to share some much-needed insight into entrepreneurial mental health with us. It's greatly appreciated and gives us a lot to think about and even more action to take, actually, whatever brand of entrepreneurship we're a part of, and it is a big community. I'd love to hear what you think about today's show and how you use Peter's advice to tackle your own entrepreneurial demons. Or your success stories, for that matter. You can send me an email at support@earlytorise.com or send Craig a message on Instagram. His account is @RealCraigBallentine. You can also tweet him @CraigBallentine on Twitter. Thanks for listening to Early to Rise Radio, and please head over to iTunes, rate today's show, share it with your friends. Don't forget, build your belief system, own your life, and never stop learning. See you next time.